You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Major Alex Pickthall is originally from the United Kingdom, where he has spent the last 14 years serving in the British Army. He is currently a Master of Advanced Study candidate at Yale University's Jackson School of Global Affairs. Al has served in a multitude of operational theaters, including Afghanistan and Iraq. In addition to working in several British embassies alongside various governmental departments and foreign partners, Major Pickthall has led soldiers on multiple combat operations during his overseas deployments. He was awarded a Military Cross for gallantry on one such deployment, the mission which we're going to discuss today. Al, welcome to The Spear.
Thank you for having me.
Al, so excited to have you here. You have a fascinating backstory. I'm really eager to get into it. Can you describe how you joined the UK Army and some of the things that you've been doing since you've been in the service?
Yeah, sure. It feels apt to describe it at West Point because it's fundamentally different. And I don't think I necessarily understood it until being here. But Sandhurst is not a university. It's 1 year. And it's predominantly a military leadership course. A lot of the people who attend Sandhurst will be graduates from a variety of schools and disciplines. Some will be non-graduates, and then there's a component of foreign cadets. But it really is, in many ways, more of a gateway to the military than it is an academic institution, whilst there is an academic department there of some renown. So I went to Sandhurst having already obtained a degree in political science. That was my first passion, as it were. And like I say, what it was for me was a very rapid introduction to the military. I was not long a sort of radical, relaxed, long-haired student. And then I found myself very quickly being introduced to military life by my color sergeant. So it's kind of worth noting that Sandhurst and West Point are very different, and that's really come through being here today. It's your foundation of military and leadership training before you then go on to do whatever it is you're going to do in the military. Whilst at Sandhurst, I applied to commission into the Household Cavalry. Mm-hmm. So more famous, possibly, for their ceremonial role, riding horses on state occasions, most recently the King's coronation. But it also has another half, which is the fighting component, for want of a better phrase, which when I joined was a reconnaissance unit, predominantly by trade. My reasons for joining the military were numerous. On my mother's side of the family, there's a lot of serving military members, and you find in the British Army, a lot of people have familial connections to the organization, not just the organization, but also the regiment that they then go and join. My godfather had been in the Household Cavalry, so that was a bit of a pull for me. And the reconnaissance role, I thought, was one of particular note and interest. So year at Sandhurst, commissioned into the Household Cavalry, and that's really how I make my way into the armed forces. It's also worth noting that at the time, I had an interest in a number of other things. Writing in particular was a great passion of mine. I'd spent some time sort of doing internships at newspapers and the like, but there was ultimately a decision to be made. The two bits of logic were, one, the military is a young man's game, come back to almost anything else. And secondly, at the time, it was at the height of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, whilst I was at Sandhurst, there was a daily drumbeat of news from the front, as it were. I had friends already serving who were in combat operations. At the time I was at Sandhurst, one of our national newspapers had an embed with a Household Cavalry squadron who had just doing the most exciting thing. And so there was this real sense of being part of an army at war and joining an army at war. And so that sort of all combined this pull to the organization. And that's really sort of how I made my way into the army.
That sounds very familiar. I think a lot of our listeners will relate to that, especially the army at war part. Can you briefly explain the regimental system to us? So that is so different from the way that we do things here in America.
Yeah, and I am sure things have probably modernized in some ways since I went through this process. But effectively, the core of the way the British Army is organized is the regimental system. And those regiments can often trace their lineage back hundreds and hundreds of years. The Household Cavalry, for example, being formed in 1660. Mm. In the infantry and the cavalry, you'll have regional regiments as well from different parts of the country. The same in other bits of the armed forces. You'll have regiments based on the origin of the people who serve within it, such as the Gurkhas, who originate from Nepal. So it is fundamentally organized around function with this overlay of regimental color. And whilst you're at Sandhurst, you apply to specific regiments. So it's even beyond applying to the infantry. Mm. You would apply to the 1st Battalion, the Grenadier Guards. You wouldn't apply to the infantry. And based on your performance at Sandhurst, an interview process, which feels probably more like applying to college in the US, you will get offers from various organizations that you've applied to, or you won't, and you will go through like a clearing system where you'll obtain a place in a unit. But it's a very different dynamic to what the students here have described to me about how they're effectively sort of allocated to places. They'll have preferences, but it feels fundamentally different. And like I say, some of the drivers for a lot of people, the guy in the room next to me at Sandhurst, his father had commanded the regiment
he wanted to join.
So that was kind of the driver for a lot of people. There were also people playing sort of a numbers game with what their units were going to be up to. At that time, you could work out on a pretty steady rotation of who was going to Afghanistan or Iraq when. And so, yeah, it's a very different system. I should add as well, you go through a period of visiting these organizations once you're at Sandhurst. I have a very strong memory of my first night in the officer's house of the Household Cavalry and thinking, this is the place for me. And so it is a two-way exchange in which you try and find your place in the army and regiments try and find the right fit for what they're looking for.
So in the U.S. system, typically an officer will move every 3 years, if not more rapidly. My understanding is the regimental system that you typically stay longer.
Yeah, so I have friends who commissioned into their various regiments and stayed there forever. And if you are fortunate enough to be selected for command of your regiment, you'll stay there till lieutenant colonel. And then beyond that, you go on to a broader general staff.
Okay.
So once you're in the heady heights of obtaining stars, you're on the general staff, which is distinct from the regimental system. However, generals will keep very close connection to their origin regiments or the regiments that they commanded. They'll often find themselves a sort of colonel of the regiment, which we use as like an honorary term.
Sure.
For sort of like godfather of the regiment.
Okay. Well, you didn't stay in your regiment though, did you? Can you talk a little bit about your thought process? What led you to get into what you got into?
Yeah, so I think the beauty of the British Army is that opportunity abounds and all sorts of different things you can go and choose to do, from attachments to different bits of the military, to becoming a pilot. So a lot of people join a particular unit and then transfer into being a pilot, or just transferring more broadly around the armed forces. Mm. I took a completely different path, one that's seen me operate in a joint environment at the highest levels of government and has seen me persistently deployed on and off ever since my initial few years. I only spent sort of 2.5, nudging 3 years with the Household Cavalry. Mm. And I think what I would describe that process for me as, well, firstly, it's something I had always wanted to do, was just always seek the next adventure. I think for a lot of people, as Afghanistan was coming to an end as a combat operation, the same with Iraq, it was looking for other opportunities to go places and continue to do different and interesting things. And for me, Specialist Operations was that avenue. And so I found myself very quickly sort of leaving the Household Cavalry behind, although I've never really left them behind. As like I say, they are a family and you can't leave family.
Oh, very good. Okay. Well, before we go into some of the things that you did after you left the regiment, I'd like to back up a little bit. And what brings you to West Point today? You mentioned that you haven't been here before. You're not familiar. And like you, I didn't go to the school. I found any number of things fascinating. So can you talk to us a little bit about your trip and some nuances that you thought were particularly memorable?
Yeah, absolutely. So also as a Sandhurst, there was a thing called the Sandhurst Cup, which was appeared to be some sort of orchestrated flogging, but culminated in a military competition that often takes place over here. That didn't strike me as a great way to spend my limited spare time at Sandhurst. So I'd never really been exposed to it. It's, West Point is probably very lazily described as like America's Sandhurst. And I've definitely been guilty of that. But it is a fundamentally different thing. Having had a pretty busy old time in the military, the opportunity presented itself to come to Yale University for a year at the very generous invitation and enablement of a fellowship scheme. And so General David Petraeus is the sort of headline name on it. And then the actual name, full name of the fellowship is the Petraeus Racanati Kaplan Fellowship. Tom Kaplan, who is our sponsor and a very passionate supporter of national security, he and his wife very kindly fund the program. And it enables for mid-career individuals from a range of backgrounds, but predominantly military, to come to Yale for a year and study for a Master's of Advanced Study in Global Affairs. The beauty of Global Affairs and the way that Yale organizes that course is that you have the freedom to choose from pretty much everything the university has to offer. You have to obtain a required amount of credits, but quite frankly, how you do that is open to negotiation. So I've taken classes at Jackson relating to what you might describe as strict international relations subject matters, great power competition, and the like. I'm also taking classes on climate change and renewable energy. I've been fortunate enough to take a couple of classes at the School of Management. For example, one of them's on organizational strategy, and taking a class on international law at Yale Law School, which
amazing.
Is the number one law school in the country,
absolutely,
and arguably the world, where you're exposed to levels of expertise that you just don't get outside of an Ivy League university. So yeah, so I found myself at Yale, and through any number of people, I keep hearing the refrain, you must get yourself to West Point. And the interesting thing is that's across a range of disciplines. It's not just, oh, you went to Sandhurst during the military, you'll find it interesting. It has been on a number of subjects. So the School of Management, about organizational strategy and leadership. So I've come up to speak to the people here who are involved in sort of that as a behavioral science and the selection of commanders, talking to people about counterterrorism and the future of counterterrorism. So coming to see the Counterterrorism Center, and more broadly, just the fact that this is an academic hub. So I'm taking a class on international law at the law school, I'm writing a paper, and I keep referencing work from the Lieber Institute. Really does feel natural that I found myself at West Point on the basis that it is a multidiscipline academic institution closely aligned to military excellence. And that's sort of what my experience of Yale has been about. So that's kind of how I found myself here today. And then hopefully in giving some talks to the students, not leading them down too many terrible avenues, but imparting, trying to give something back as well. But yeah, that's really why. It's just been a constant refrain, you must get yourself to West Point. So here I am.
I'm glad to hear that. And you brought up some very interesting points. I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with what West Point is just assumes that it's an army factory, that we just churn out automatons. When we have several think tanks here. You're sitting on right now, the Modern War Institute. We have Army Cyber Institute, Lieber Institute that you mentioned, the Simon Center for the Professional Military and Ethic, any number of these organizations going on around here, really is a hub of learning, not just for the military, but for the rest of academia. And we talked about this briefly before we started recording. As you know, I went to Yale too as a Jackson guy back when it was an institute. Shout out to Jim Levinson and his team. But I went in with some very different misperceptions about what it was going to be like to go to school. I was in my late 30s. I'd been to Iraq and Afghanistan 7 times. Like you, I spent some time in some special units. And I expected to fight hippies on the green every Friday and all this ridiculousness that just didn't happen. What I found was a pretty warm and accepting learning environment there. And I wonder what your experiences was like there as well with the broader institution at Yale.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I think a lot of my friends before I came over, there was a lot of jokes about you know, you're not going to be welcomed and careful what you say. Yeah. And my experience couldn't be farther from that. It has been incredibly welcoming, just on a personal level. You know, I'm not wearing a uniform every day. Right. Nobody knows who I am. But even once you sort of get talking about backgrounds and experience, it's mostly intrigue, just what's it like to be in the military. So it's fundamentally a welcoming place. I would say Yale is especially good in terms of its relations with the military. Mm. Both serving, previously serving, it really does seem to make an effort to go above and beyond in fostering that relation. I mean, the Schwarzman Center in the center of campus is basically one of the most beautiful war memorials you'll ever see. I attended my first ever sort of Veterans Day service. It has really gone to great lengths to foster a good relationship with the military, which is encouraging. I think as well, it's worth noting that it goes beyond that, though. It's not about just being friendly. It's not about just providing opportunity. Albeit, I would say that some of the opportunities I have seen are remarkable and things to take home as lessons. You know, meeting former serving soldiers who have either had to retire through injury or the military wasn't for them, or being offered the ability to go back to school as undergraduates is a special thing to see. On Yale's dime, it's a remarkable thing. But I think what I've been really impressed by is that the tone of discourse is about logic.
Mm.
And if you can argue your point one way or the other to a standard where you can evidence it, provide logic, politics actually really isn't the primary motivator for people disagreeing with you. It's actually reasoned logic. And students and faculty alike are just intrigued and want to know what I think one is able to provide as someone who's been there and done it, and it being only the military side, because you can't really throw a cup without hitting an ambassador. So you can't really act like you're the only person who's been overseas. But just a different perspective to inform their views, and for all the books they can read and podcasts they can listen to, looking someone in the eyes who said, well, actually, it's not always quite so simple when you're there. That has been a fascinating experience. And I hope we've sort of added some value to those students' experiences. But first and foremost, it is just an amazingly advanced academic institution that prides itself on excellence. And like I say, you just sort of walk around. It's a bit like Disneyland, except rather than a ride, it's a student who wants to tell you about how he thinks he's cracked carbon removal, or the quantum computing department want to say, yeah, we think we're not that far from quantum teleportation. And so you just walk around with sort of wide eyes thinking, this is a remarkable place. Yeah, so it's been unreal. I'm incredibly grateful to the fellowship, to Yale, to the Jackson School. There's some really important people. Emma Skye, who runs the International Leadership Center at Jackson, she herds us as best as we can be herded as a group of cats. And really, the university ensures that we have a good time and that we're well looked after. And I'm genuinely appreciative of that.
It's interesting that you mentioned Emma, who is also from the UK and also spent a lot of time overseas. She was there when I was at Jackson also, and when the recorders were off, I need to tell you a story about her visit here. As you might imagine, it was quite fun. Thank you. Thank you, Emma. So, Al, you mentioned earlier that you were into writing before you joined. Is that something you continued after you became an officer?
Yeah, but not necessarily as a hobby or out of choice. The British military operates in a written tradition. ETs are primary method of communicating information, particularly when you're at reach.
Absolutely.
It is also one of the key responsibilities of an officer, in that it is how you report on those you lead. And if you're a bad writer, you're going to do them a disservice. One thing I remember from my pre-military writing is, you know, it's very cliche, but it's cliche for a reason, is know your audience and understand what they want and deliver information to them in the manner that they would like. On the writing for careers thing, there are boards that have to sit through hundreds of reports in a day and make some pretty big decisions about people's lives. And to stand out and represent your people in that environment, there is only one method for doing so, and it's writing well. So I think the first thing I'd say is that as a leader, if you write badly, for a start, you're probably doing those you lead a disservice and their careers a disservice. And I take that pretty seriously as a responsibility. Not out of some noble sense of being a good leader, but like, you get to know these people and you want the best for them. And it's also not the hardest thing to do in the world. just develop your writing and understand your audience in that situation. So firstly, it's a responsibility of being a good leader is to be a good writer. Secondly, if you want to create space for soldiers to go and do what they do better than anyone else, it's going to involve at some point writing a brief to someone to convince them that your idea is a good one. I fear that at times we've lost sight of that. I often find myself encouraging those I lead to write more naturally, less acronyms, less military, pick up a good book, a good long form article in the New Yorker. And that is the kind of writing you want to aim for, because that's the kind of writing that engages the reader. Doesn't matter that on this occasion, the reader is the Secretary of State for Defense or a two-star general or whoever it is. They need to be engaged and they need to buy your narrative, what you're telling them. And so, again, that's partially a responsibility of good leadership, because you're going to make it happen, whatever it is, by writing well about it. But it's also how you convey messages. You know, when you've got 30 minutes in an embassy to send that message back to London, and you've got however many characters, because let's face it, people aren't going to read past side two.
Right.
They haven't got the time. You've got to make it count. And so it's one of the most fundamental skills for an officer is to be able to write well.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the things we impart to the cadets here, especially the younger ones. Like, hey, sir, why do I have to take these writing classes? I want to be an officer in the Army. I'm not going to need that. And I'm thinking today, when we're done here and I take you back over to Department of Social Sciences, today is the SOSH run. Did they explain that to you?
No.
So the SS-307 International Relations Introduction is a core course every cadet here has to take. It's administered by the Department of Social Sciences, which is where I got hired to teach. So I worked in SOSH for 3 years before I moved on here at West Point. And they're culminating paper for that course. We call it the SOSH paper. Deeply analytical piece about a specific IR subject. It changes year to year. The tradition here at West Point is to dress up and present this to your instructor. And you'll see this when we go over there. And cadets can do any manner of things. I've seen chariots. I've seen rock stars. One cadet jumped in with, they're on the parachute team, parachuted in with their paper to present it. So that's an interesting concept that they do in social science. I bring that up because many cadets resent having to write deeply and thoughtfully, and also having to write succinctly. They're two different types. And it's good to hear someone from who's non-instructor at West Point say, hey, this is important not only for you, but also for your unit and to take care of your troops. You're going to have to write counseling statements. You're going to have to write recommendations for Uniform Corps of Military Justice or for awards. And if you can't do that well, just like you said, your troops are the ones that are going to suffer.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd also say, firstly, that element of theater is interesting because it links to the second most important skill after writing well, which is speaking well. If you can't brief people convincingly, you're going to suffer, both in terms of just your career, but more importantly, conveying ideas you have, whether they're good or not. If your presentation's bad, you could have the best mission plan in the world. It doesn't matter, because the people you're trying to convince of that have spent most of the brief thinking, why can't this man brief?
Right.
And so the theater of briefing is not necessarily as dramatic as parachuting in with a paper, but there's still theater to it. There is definitely still theater to it. And if you don't understand that you're trying to capture and hold someone's attention, you're trying to impart the things they're interested in before they know that's the part they're interested in. You know, for a politician or a senior commander, he probably really wants to know about the risks. Yet that's most often the thing people just kind of fall off. So they're so busy doing the detail of, well, this guy's going to be here and the helicopters will go here. So yeah, he kind of expects that stuff to sort of flow that way, but he wants to know about the risks. And presenting is an art form, capturing attention, keeping it, getting the person who's on the receiving end to hear what they need to hear so that it's not being swept up at the end. It is, like I say, I think after writing, it's the second most important skill you can have. And there's some theater in there. And that's an important thing to remember is, I think people often think that in bureaucratic organizations like the military, and that's bureaucratic not as a pejorative statement, like out of necessity to organize themselves and run, they have to be bureaucratic. There is still room for personality and breaking out of the molds of this is the format for how you do it. No general is going to turn around and go, oh, I'm not sure about the font he used on those slides. If it was a good brief, he was engaged and you answered his or her questions. So, there's still room for theater.
So that's another interesting point that you brought up. Something I found, and I wonder if it's the same for you, that effectiveness of communication, be that oral or written, is tied to our credibility. Like you said, if you get up, if you have a bunch of distracting mannerisms, for example, if you have a bunch of filler words, which is unfortunate, you'll find people are counting your filler words instead of paying attention to what you're talking about. And the credibility that we have leads to our freedom of action. So if you get up, if you dork up the briefing, you're not going to be credible, not going to trust you, you're going to have zero freedom of action. Whereas if you have a solid plan that you can present well, it's understandable, you address the commander's concerns, you're going to have initial credibility, and that's going to give you freedom of action. Have you found something similar, or do you disagree?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I would also go one step further, which is particularly when you're at a place like West Point or Sandhurst, It feels very army, because you see army.
Yes.
And that's your tribe, and your tribe speak your language. The real world is not like that. You're exposed to every other tribe under the sun, particularly when you're in operation, and they don't speak your language necessarily. They might also not like elements of your culture. And so I think a really important element is having empathy for other tribes, as it were, the audiences beyond your own. If you get up and speak to a cross-government group of people in army acronyms at a million miles an hour with 400 slides with font 7 detailing actions on someone forgets their sandwich, you've lost the crowd, and you're ultimately doing yourself and the organization you represent a disservice. So I think it's about understanding that nothing gets solved with one organization alone. It takes many, and as part of being able to form teams, which is a crucial element of leadership, if the majority of the team is not from your organization, you have to have empathy for their perception of you. And the quickest way you can lose the crowd is to talk to them in terms that they won't understand, in a style that is foreign to them, or even perhaps intimidating, alienating.
Or offensive.
Yeah, offensive. And so it's about having empathy for your audience. Yeah, I think that's really important.
So how does that develop? Because, for example, you are in a familiar but nonetheless foreign country right now. You are not necessarily with your tribe that you've been in for so long, but you seem very comfortable and accepted there. How does that develop as an Army officer? Is that something that's internal, or can we create that in the ranks?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, firstly, crushing failure is always a great way to learn. So there's nothing like having a very senior person say, I didn't understand a word of that sentence, to really remind you that you should probably speak in plain English. Travel broadens the mind incredibly. The more you can go to other places where they don't see things the same way you see things, but you still want output and you want results, you've got no choice. You've got to start understanding their drivers, their motivations. There's probably an element of just inquisitiveness there. If you're interested in other cultures and other ways of doing things, that's healthy. In terms of how you develop it, you basically force circumstances for those things. So you put people in uncomfortable situations where they will have to brief and talk to people who aren't from their background, organization, whatever, and they will fail. You broaden the mind with travel, with exchanges, with exposure to different organizations. I have no doubt that when I go home after being at Yale, my friends will probably ridicule some of the things I say, because I will have adapted, you know, because you're forced to when you go elsewhere. So it's really just, I was fortunate enough last night to go and see the shooting team.
Yeah, combat weapons team.
Yeah, and combat weapons team. One of the students asked about that, you know, we somehow got onto writing and speaking and briefing. And I said, if I gave a random person a pistol now in this room and said, do what that guy just did, how do you think that would go? Badly. What would be the thing that would change that? Practice and training. There is no rocket science to it. Thinking is a skill, writing is a skill, briefing is a skill. Being around people and being able to adapt to different environments with different people is a skill developed over time. And so training and practice is the way you accelerate skill development, and it's exactly the same for dealing with people outside of the organization. And the difference between people who are quite good at it and very good at it is personal drive to achieve it themselves. The organization has a responsibility to do it up to a point, but if you have an inclination towards being outside of your comfort zone, travel, reading and writing about different things that unnecessarily in your lane. I'd say that's another point. A noticeable streak amongst the very best people I've led is that they're really interested in things that have nothing to do with their job. It can be high academia in some cases, not that often, or it can just be other thing. It doesn't matter what, but it's an intellectual inquisitiveness about things outside of their own lives and work. And that inquisitiveness tends to correlate with being good at their job in the military.
It's interesting that you brought up the combat weapons team. That you probably heard last night that they're West Point's most recent national champions, having triumphed over a number of really good teams, including Texas A&M and Navy. And while not unique to West Point, it's very interesting that you identified some of the things I think make that team successful. They're very specially trained. Tryouts are super hard. 70 competed this past year for seven slots. They work their butts off. And also, I think personally, what I think makes them so good, the special sauce is what they call it, is they're probably their civilian instructors. There's three instructors that are local law enforcement that volunteer their time to train the cadets, which seems to be the determinative factor. So in terms of your upbringing and the units that you've been in, have you had mentors or coaches that have helped you get to the place where you are now, the success that you're having in the military and in life in general?
Yeah, so the British military has definitely attempted to sort of have a formalized mentoring scheme. It's encouraged that at various points during my time serving. I don't think knowingly entered into a formal mentoring relationship with anyone. And actually, I think I would find that quite an artificial construct.
Absolutely.
But I have, however, had lots of mentors. So those two things, I guess I'd make that point, is that those two things are separate and you don't need a formal scheme for this. I've been incredibly fortunate to have some remarkable mentors. I would also add, before I talk about the success stories, there is also nothing more instructive than having a bad leader. And that happens too. And so you can learn just as much from that. So my first point would be, it is important to be observing those who lead you, no matter their quality, your relationship to them. There is always something you can learn from them. I suppose the point I make about mentoring is that often my best mentors have been people that ostensibly I've been leading. So some of the enlisted soldiers who I've been fortunate enough to command have taught me some of the most important lessons that I have learned. And that's a reciprocal relationship, I would hope, in that I hope I passed on a thing or two. A lot of my mentors have actually been people who in the rank structure are junior to me, but a couple of the senior soldiers of troops that I was fortunate enough to command, who in no uncertain terms made clear what the command dynamic was in my early years, were incredibly instructive, hugely experienced soldiers who've been overseas many, 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 many times. It's the shared car journeys, it's the grabbing a coffee together, it's the long haul flight. It's not formalized mentoring, it's just picking brains and asking questions and again being inquisitive. Those are the foundational experiences of what I describe as mentoring, which might sound counterintuitive. These are people I'm ostensibly commanding, but that's the foundation for me. If someone said, what's the most important mentoring? It was that in my early years. Since then, it's taking a bit from everyone you serve under. And I've been fortunate to serve under some truly exceptional, remarkable commanders, and each has their own way of doing business. And it's about picking a percent or two from each one. I also think, a bit like leading and following is often described, to be mentored, you have to be open to it.
Yeah.
And that's something I was probably quite bad at as a junior officer, in the sense of just kind of having the humility to say, how could I do that better? Rather than sort of walking away from, that didn't go that well, move on, let's put it behind us. Going back and going, actually, no, how could I have done that better? And so I'd say being mentored is, it's not a passive process. You have to seek it out and have the humility to say, how did I do that better? What did I get wrong? And that's a decision that everyone can make individually. So regardless of whether there's formal mentoring schemes or your relationship with those you command, you can make an active choice to go and seek feedback and get better.
Totally. I could not agree more. My first platoon sergeant, when I was an infantry officer in the 101st Sergeant First Class, earlier, Edwards, taught me so much, largely by letting me have these little failures that you talked about. When it's just us, company commander's not around, battalion commander's not watching, but let the lieutenant experiment, find out what works for him and what doesn't. And I always appreciated that, learned a lot from the same thing throughout the years with the non-commissioned officers and the officers. Also agree with you that we can learn a lot from bad leaders as well. What's interesting for me is being a product of the Reserve Officer Training Corps, not having gone to West Point, I went to a school called Mercer in Georgia Military College down in Georgia. The best leaders and the worst leaders in my career, for the most part, have been West Point grads. And it's been very interesting. So on the best side, you get like General Stanley McChrystal and Colonel Pat Howell. On the bad side, don't need to name names, but both of them, it's been quite a big dynamic. But I've always learned things. I think there's a lot we can learn from saying, I'm never going to do that. or this wasn't a good way to lead. And I think that's been helpful over my years as well. So Al, that's all essential backstory to get to what we're here to talk about today, which was for the operation for which you earned the Military Cross. So I know what the Military Cross is. I realize what a big deal that is, but I think many of our readers will not. So can you explain a little bit what that is? And then we'll go into the story of how you ended up receiving it.
Sure. So in the British Honours and Awards is the official title for it. In that system, you have categories of awards, and there is a category of awards for gallantry. And the essential criteria for that is that it has to be an act of bravery. Most of the awards have a caveat of having to have been in the face of the enemy, although there are several with exceptions for that. For example, that would be an act of bravery involved in, say, like a road traffic accident,
sure,
or something like that. So, yeah, there are phenomenal acts of bravery into a burning building to rescue people, absent the enemy. But there is then a distinct category of awards which relate to actions in the face of the enemy. And of the three main national awards, the Military Cross is one of those. And in our system, we don't have as many medals or ribbons and things that go on our uniforms, but it is an award presented to you by a senior member of the royal family.
Mm.
In my case, it was Queen Elizabeth II.
Mm.
It also grants you the right to have the letters of your award after your name for the rest of life. So my formal title ends with MC. So, and that stays with you forever. And those are the national awards. So you'll see MC, CGC, and then Victoria Cross VC.
OBE?
So OBE is a separate category of award,
okay,
which is for significant and notable a national service, relates to things that are not in the face of the enemy, not related to gallantry.
Got it.
So an OBE or MBE would be for a particularly good professional performance, but not relating to gallantry in the face of the enemy. And so the Military Cross is one of these awards for actions in the face.
That's really interesting. And growing up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, someone being affiliated with an MC in their name had a completely different meaning. So I'm glad that you clarified that for me.
Yeah, I occasionally joke that it is either because of my membership of a motorcycle club or for my remarkable rapping skills. But it's a huge thing in the UK in terms of, like I say, those letters stay with you forever. It's a pretty remarkable experience.
For sure. So thank you for explaining that to the audience. So the circumstances for which you received the Military Cross, can you explain a little bit about the type of unit you were in, and generalities about the type of mission, and some specifics about what happened?
Yeah, so it was in Afghanistan. I was actually still serving with the Household Cavalry at the time. The Household Cavalry was very fortunate to be given a very specific role called the Brigade Reconnaissance. It was an interesting approach. It was a squadron of Household Cavalry soldiers supplemented with expertise from elsewhere, including a reconnaissance platoon from an infantry battalion, engineers, medics. And it was really, Brigade Reconnaissance Force kind of implies that it was mostly doing reconnaissance, clues in the name. That wasn't really what it was. So you had the British Army at the time was responsible for Helmand Province in southern Afghanistan, and the vast majority of British forces were in ground-holding roles. So in patrol bases, forward operating bases throughout Helmand, ground-holding, mostly with infantry units, in what one might unfairly describe as sort of typical counterinsurgency, trying to train local Afghans, create security pockets for political endeavors. Overlaid on top of that, you had the Brigade Reconnaissance Force, which was mostly a striking and raiding force rather than reconnaissance. At the time, it was starting to shift away from large-scale combat operations. The Taliban were going through a bit of a resurgence. There had been several high-profile attacks on British bases in Helmand, and you had this sliver of Helmand mostly based along the rivers where British forces were based. And then you kind of had this outer ring, which was absent any real security structure. And that's where the weapons were flowing in, supplies, fighters. So our job was to act as a raiding and striking force in depth of the ground-holding units in an effort to prevent weapons and resources flowing into Taliban fighters. And the main one being explosives for improvised explosive devices, which were wreaking havoc across Helmand Province. And so that was kind of the setup. And we were incredibly busy. It was a fascinating 6 months where we would get a mixture of either short notice calls to operations where some intelligence would come in that there was a horde of explosives somewhere, get to it quickly to destroy it, or mixed alongside more deliberate raids onto areas where weapons were being kept. And it really was, for us, it was not about manhunting. It was about searching for the resources. He was trying to cut off the logistics chain that was enabling the Taliban to sustain its efforts.
So what year was this when you were there?
That was 2013. Yeah, that's right, 2013. And so it was at a point where I think there was some uncertainty about where the campaign was going to go next. And so there was a sense of how much more fighting was going to take place over how many more years, an effort to consolidate existing gains. And so we actually found ourselves employed maybe a bit more on the basis that rather than ground holding units sort of endlessly feeling the need to reconsolidate the gains already made and experience some really quite heavy fighting, there was the sense of consolidating what we have and then protect that around the edges. And that's where we came in.
And what was your role in the Household Guards when you were there this time?
So I was a troop leader. So we had four troops, and I was a troop leader, one of the four troops.
All right, so Hellman was always kind of pretty sporty. There was always a lot of things going on, even, I mean, 2013. Yeah, that was after my last tour there, but still pretty active. So what was the general sense in your unit at this time? The war had been going on for 12 years at this point, and many more to go, as we know now. So was the morale good in the unit? Were people happy to be there? What was the general sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for all the political noise around the edges, you will find that soldiers want to do what they're trained to do, for better or worse. And that was no different. For the vast majority of people, it was not their first deployment. Mm. But that was because our unit had the ability to be a bit selective about who was in it, which is fortunate. But yeah, a general sense of excitement and wanting to go and do a good job and wanting to look after your friends. And I think also a sense that whilst acknowledging that it was a politically complicated picture, particularly once you got there and there were members of the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police who were fighting and dying at scale, and the reality of what Taliban rule had looked like and might look like, there wasn't really a sense of like doubt about it, not a significant one. And so morale was high, particularly the role we were in. It was like a very privileged role. Like, you know, it sounds silly, but below our brigade badge, we had a little badge that said BRF. We'd obviously get in a lot of trouble for pretending we were special forces, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it felt a bit different for the guys from a normal deployment that they had had previously. So, yeah, there was morale was high. And like I say, soldiers want to do what they're trained for. You can, up to a point, block out the political noise, not least because you've got a job to do at the time. And
absolutely.
You
have
to focus it on it and look after yourself and those around you.
So the job that you had to do on the events of the Military Cross, can you tell us what led up to it and then go into what happened the day of?
Yeah, so it's actually a bit of an odd one in that the award is accumulative in part. So it was sort of a number of incidents, but sort of they have a theme running through them. I guess, to be brutally frank, what had led up to this. So when I commissioned from Sandhurst, I joined a cavalry unit, but decided that I would go and do the infantry officer training course.
Okay.
Which is very odd for a cavalry officer. The method by which I got myself on this, so I went to see the adjutant of the House of Cavalry and said, I'd like to do the infantry officer course. And he said, no. And I said, okay. He then went on leave, and I went to see the stand-in adjutant and said, I'd like to do the officer course. And he said, I don't really care. Shouldn't go and do it. I'm the stand-in. And so I sort of, by hook or by crook, got myself on that course in Wales. Fantastic course. Really well-run infantry training on all the skills you need should you have your worst day. But one of the things that they hammered home was the need for offensive spirit, even if you're in a defensive situation. And a lot of the work we did in Hellman often felt defensive because you would fly somewhere to destroy explosives and you would be ambushed. Mm. And so you were very often on the back foot. It was very rare to sort of go somewhere with the intention of starting the fight in that sense. It was go and get the equipment, the explosives, all that stuff. And so we found ourselves in these defensive situations very often. And this lesson of the best way to defend yourself is with an element of offensive spirit had really stuck with me from that infantry course. And so I think throughout my time on that tour in Afghanistan, I just tried to implement that as as much as possible. The best way out of a really bad place was to fight your way out. And so I think myself and my troop had this real sense of whenever we did get in trouble or ambushed or it went wrong, was to try and maintain some offensive spirit and fight back. And so really over a number of occasions, and actually it did seem to be quite successful. You know, the last thing I think the Taliban fighting us often expected was that after they'd ambushed, we'd start coming towards them effectively. You know, obviously it was in a tactical nature, but that was really where it started. And I just had this really strong sense of if that was going to be something the troop did, I would have to lead by example. I was very fortunate to be blessed with an incredibly courageous troop who were willing to go along with it, although I don't think many of them would have thanked me at the time. But and actually one of the other guys in the troop, one of the section commanders, so the troop was organized into three sections, was also awarded an MC for the same tour. And we just built this real sense of when we came under attack, we would fight back. And that's what it was really all about. And there was nothing complicated to it. It was just infantry tactics. It was what we had been taught. And it wasn't necessarily intuitive, not least because by that stage, we were all carrying and wearing so much protective equipment that running through a field wasn't all that easy. We just started to build this sort of momentum and confidence in doing that because it did seem to end things. And then we started to expand that a bit. We got more preemptive. So on another instance, how it would tend to happen is you'd get there, get settled in, start searching some compounds, start finding stuff. And then the radio chatter would begin. Then you'd start getting told by things in the air, this doesn't look good over there. This thing's moving towards you. This thing's moving over here. And traditionally what we would do is wait, get attacked, ambushed, and then fight back. So then we started expanding that to, well, why wait till then? So we had another incident where we were told, oh, it looks like there's the group of men, they look armed, they're about 300 meters to your whatever it was, and it looks like they're starting to set up. And so that day, for example, we thought, well, we'll go first. And so made best speed, you know, sort of across an open field, thinking if we get there first or can surprise them, you know, we might be able to get the jump on them. And on that occasion, the first time we tried that, we were fortunate enough to do so. We managed to basically catch them in the act of setting up an ambush and detained a number of them, which were literally, they quite clearly dumped their rifles when they'd heard us coming around the corner, and then we just stood there saying, oh, we live here. And the Afghans, we had Afghans with us, and they're like, no, these are not locals, and those weapons have just been put down there. So again, this building of sort of offensive spirit was the thing. And you know, no matter the situation, whether we're about to be or had been ambushed or come under attack, to fight back. And then I guess this sort of trend continued. And then ultimately, the thing that probably was the main feature of the citation for my military cross, it was actually, I think, if not our very last or our penultimate operation, it was part of our handover to the incoming unit. Again, very similar to the model I described, intelligence of some explosives. I think it was actually a threat of a rocket attack on some of our bases. And it was this operation designed to go and disrupt that, to get to the explosives, the rockets, whatever. And in an area we'd been before where it was always been pretty faulty, and then got there, everything went very well. Found some explosive, not that much, actually very quiet. And as we were starting to withdraw as a squadron across quite a long frontage, that's when all hell broke loose. And an element of the squadron became effectively pinned down. And there was very limited opportunity for them to move during the course of that. And in the confusion, there was a casualty taken. So that goes out across the radios that someone had been shot. And really, my troop by this stage, that narrative I told of that sort of offensive spirit, and the only way to fix these moments is to get up and go and do something about it. We decided that was what we were going to do then as well. That a number of us were going to get up, go to this group that were pinned down, who'd taken the casualty, and do something about it. Interestingly, at this stage, we were close to the end of deployment. I'd be a liar if I didn't say that plays on people's minds.
Right.
I think I'm almost at the finish line. And so I said to a number of people in my troop, look, I don't think this takes all of us. Maybe a couple of us will go, but like, don't feel compelled. We don't know what's over there yet. If we need more, we can take more. But I'm going to go and try and figure out what's going on, and then we'll take it from there. And pretty remarkably, a whole group of guys were like, we're coming to. And as we set off from behind cover, I have such a vivid memory of sort of looking back at this group of lunatics and thinking, that's quite something that they all wanted to come.
Right.
And they all wanted to be part of it. And they all wanted to do their bit and help. And that was quite something. And yeah, so we arrived to find quite a melee. It was, you know, as anyone who's been in sort of contact in Afghanistan or elsewhere would recognize the scene. People sort of desperately trying to bury into the ground, that kind of thing. Bits of tree ringing off all over the place around you. And really, it was just a case of sort of trying to work out what's going on. And it was much easier arriving as almost an outsider with a bit of perspective on what had been going on elsewhere, where the moving parts were to get things going and try and get the casualty out of there, try and coordinate some other movements through some armored vehicles, pull them forward and that sort of thing. And that really was the sort of the final incident that sort of led to the military cross, as I understand it. And then very strangely, you find yourself a few months later in a castle with Her Majesty the Queen putting one on your chest. And we're very fortunate because the household element of the household covering refers to the royal household. And so we have a very strong bond with the monarch. And we were very fortunate that we had a sort of little reception afterwards for just the people from the household covering to have a conversation with the Queen. I guess my big reflection on all of it is that gallantry awards are a reflection of when things have gone horribly wrong. And because of that, it's quite hard to sort of wear as a badge of honor, more sort of something as a useful reminder every now and then of why it's so important to get things right in the first place so you don't ever have to find yourself in those sorts of situations again. And also, yeah, if I'm brutally honest, on my behalf, there were many other people in that troop who were just as brave as I was. Fortunately, one of them was also given a military cross, but many others who were just as, if not braver. And I really do like to think of it as it was recognition for what the troop had achieved more than anything else, and achieved when things had gone wrong. Ultimately, yeah, you would hope actually a better result is no one comes back with any gallantry things, because
right.
There'd be no need for it.
Right.
But as it is, it's a mixed thing. And I'm sure the same would be said by anyone else who's.
Well, that was an amazing conversation, Alan. I'm cognizant that I've got to take you back over to the Department of Social Sciences and get you set up to watch the SOCH run, which I think will be an interesting topic for when you go back home. So I would like to close with one final question. Knowing what you know now, what kind of advice would you give to aspiring professionals who want to join the profession of arms?
It's incredibly expansive. Because I could probably go on for days, if not weeks, on thoughts on this. I think my key one is to remember that it is a profession. And I don't mean in the sense that you've got a responsibility to be good because you're earning a wage for it. There is often this sense of great military commanders and leaders throughout history almost having an artistic flair for it. And there is no doubting that some people's, for whatever reason, nature, nurture, develop certain skills that lend themselves to leading well. But I don't buy the artistic flair argument. It is the profession of leading men and women in the military is a skill. There are multiple components to it. But like I was saying about writing, speaking, interpersonal skills, whatever, you can practice, train, and get better at it. And if you make that not necessarily your life's work, but you make it a major component of your life, you will get better at it. And you might find some doors closed because you're not suited to a particular element of military life. You might find that you struggle in a particular area or you have a natural tendency towards another. But perseverance of just getting better is what will ultimately set you apart. Yeah, a lot, particularly in the British military, we like this sort of idea of we're sort of amateurs really who happen to have a profession and whatever, but it is, being a good leader is the result of being proficient in a number of skills, and you can just get better at them. And the main motivator for getting better, or the main driver, or the main enabler of getting better at all those skills, is an inquisitiveness about the world around you. Read broadly outside of your lane, your subject. Speak to people from different backgrounds, different industries. You'd be amazed where you'd find the most interesting, amazing leadership lessons from someone who's run a family business somewhere, or a hedge fund, or you name it. So get driven by an inquisitiveness about your profession, because that will be the enabler to developing a broad range of skills that will make you a better leader. That's it. That's it. Be inquisitive, develop those skills, because anyone up to a point can do this. There is no natural artistic flair to it. I just don't buy that.
Well, Al, thank you so much for your time today. This is an amazing discussion. On behalf of Colonel Pat Sullivan and the staff here at the Modern War Institute, I'd like to present you with the rare and coveted Modern War Institute coin. I know you and I were joking beforehand about the Americans' obsession with these coins. Got this here for you as a memento of appreciation. And thank you. And I look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.